The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the podcast Be My Guest with Ina Garten. Be My Guest is intimate and captivating conversations with new and old friends, David Remick, Jennifer Garner, Frank Bruni, and more. Listen to Be My Guest with Ina Garten wherever you get your podcasts.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
WNYC Studios is brought to you by ZBiotics. Seize the day after a night of drinks with ZBiotics Pre-Alcohol Probiotic Drink. ZBiotics was invented by PhD scientists to break down the byproduct of alcohol, which is most responsible for making you feel crummy the next day. Drink ZBiotics before your first drink, drink responsibly, and you'll wake up refreshed and ready to take on the day. Try it for yourself at ZBiotics.com/WNYC and get 15% off your first order when you use WNYC at checkout. That's ZBiotics.com/WNYC and use the code WNYC at checkout for 15% off.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Lily Gladstone has been in over a dozen films, including Kelly Reichardt's Certain Women. And she's been on Reservation Dogs, created by Sterling Harjo. But making a life as an actor, it's just not an easy thing. And Gladstone said she was applying for seasonal work at the Department of Agriculture studying insects when she heard from a certain Martin Scorsese. Scorsese eventually cast her as a lead in Killers of the Flower Moon. The film concerns a grisly series of murders that took place in the Osage Nation after oil was discovered there. Gladstone plays Molly Burkhart, an Osage woman married to a white man named Ernest, played in the film by Leonardo DiCaprio. Gladstone is nominated for the Academy Award for Best Actress, and that's a historic first for a Native woman. She spoke recently with Michael Shulman, a staff writer at The New Yorker.
Your high school yearbook from Mount Lake Terrace High School has made the rounds online, so I know that you were voted most likely to win an Oscar. There's no question it's true.
It's really sweet. My graduating class and then a lot of people that were in the same drama program, they're reuniting to watch the Oscars in our old high school theater. It's really touching.
Well, so then you went and studied acting and directing at the University of Montana. I'm curious, when you got out, what your early career was like. What kind of roles were you auditioning for? What were you getting? And what kind of day jobs were you doing for survival?
I decided to stay in Montana instead of going to LA or New York like a lot of my graduating class did, because I kind of felt like if I had gone to LA or New York and done like the classic, you know, just audition endlessly, hold down another job to support yourself, you know, get an agent, get out there as much as possible. Just thinking about it was starting to kill my passion for it a little. So I stayed in Montana, where I had built some connections with some local filmmakers that I really liked. In between the theater tours, I auditioned for a one-woman show that toured into schools teaching about Native American boarding school experience. So it was like a teacher-actor position that I had for a number of years.
And that I read about this. This was like you were acting against a recorded track in school auditoriums. Can you tell me what that was?
Yeah, it's a Seattle-based company called Living Voices, and I was performing a show that was teaching about Native American boarding school experience and with historical documents projected through, like, behind you on the screen, and pre-recorded voices from other actors that etch out this period in history. The character I played was Dene, and she was a boarding school survivor who had gone through the Ganado Mission Hospital and trained to become a nurse, and to become a nurse in World War II, and then was kind of in a letter correspondence with her her clan brother, who had become a Navajo code talker. So I was teaching a little bit about that history as well. So I did that for as many years as I could in my 20s, but kind of got burned out on it because, you know, it's also a heavy task to walk in with, you know, this one specific curriculum, but finding that you have to do so much just 101 before you even start the show, you know, contextualizing that there's 574 different tribal nations in the United States. And, you know, we all look different ways now and we all come from different backgrounds and we have a lot of different languages. And yes, we're still here. And no, we don't still live in teepees. You know, a lot of us still have them, but like, you know, but not every Native nation had lodges, you know, just little things like that.
Right. And little then there's like a sophomore sleeping in the first row or something.
Oh, yeah.
Teens are a tough audience.
Teens are the toughest audience. I kind of found, I know teachers at the middle school level get burned out, but I've found that middle schoolers are kind of the best audience for that kind of thing. They're still young enough to really enjoy the theater of it and to like buy into the magical realism, suspension of disbelief. But they're also sophisticated enough to like grasp concepts of, yes, the assimilation policy was really bad for Native people. Yeah, that was it was really rewarding but incredibly exhausting work, as any teacher will attest. So that job kept me going, supplementing between cashiering at Staples and then every once in a while having an independent film that I would get to go do. But the assumption that I've also found as a Native actor is there's a lot of roles that I've played now that's required that I speak another Indigenous language. And I'm by no means even fluent in Blackfeet. You know, I can introduce myself. I have a few words and phrases. I know some of the bad words. But
can you please curse in Blackfeet right now? I want to hear.
I'm just going to drop this from my Blackfeet folks, but I'm not going to say what it means. Siksimisi, one of the worst things and funniest things you can say about somebody. And, you know, right. it's a fairly PG thing, but, you know, it's my favorite word in our language. So I think that's an aspect of Native performance that I think a lot of people take for granted, is how hard it is. You know, we celebrate other actors for picking up other, like, European languages for a role, for scenes and sounding proficient and fluent. But for some reason, that same awe and that same credit is often just kind of dismissed for Native actors because people assume, oh, that you all speak that. It's like, no, it's a huge gift to be able to speak an Indigenous language.
I want to move on to Kill to the Flower Moon and your character, Molly. The movie is based on the book by our colleague here at The New Yorker, David Gran. When you were figuring out how to play Molly, you know, she was a real person who made real choices and lived through very extreme circumstances. What was most familiar about her and what was most enigmatic or obscure to you?
In reading the book particularly, I got a sense of the kind of person that I was recognized or that I would recognize in my own community. The kind of like, you know, the women I recognized from my grandma's side of the family, my Nez Perce side. What was really exciting was the idea of having a chance to kind of break some stereotypes with her as well in her relationship with her sisters. Relationship that like Native women have with each other, especially our families. It's like, we're very like, you know, we love being together. We love joking. We love gossiping and teasing. And, you know, I could really see that with like my grandma's sisters, the way that they were together, being very proper still, but just giggling about everything. And that's like not the Native woman that you're used to seeing in cinema. It's like, you're used to seeing more like a stoic, like kind of mean, whatever. And it's like, well, it's because there's outsiders around, you know, people
of
are
course,
a little bit
right,
more guarded.
Yeah.
You know, like I said, I didn't want to overextend like my own cultural understanding into Molly as an Osage woman, but it was a basis. A lot of the familiarity I felt with her that reminded me of stories I'd heard about my great grandma Lily, who I never met. She passed before I was born. I could hear echoed. I could see maybe where Gran had gotten his illustration, the way that he was able to sketch Molly, the way that he drew her personality. I could feel that.
And Molly has a very strange and conflicted relationship with her husband, Ernest, played by Leonardo DiCaprio. I want to zero in on my favorite scene in the film, a scene that's up there with the all-time great Martin Scorsese scenes, which is their first date when she invites him to dinner at her house and they're flirting, they're smoking, and she kind of calls him out as a coyote and says, coyote wants money.
Yeah.
And then offers him whiskey.
Echo.
Coyote.
Coyote wants money.
Well, that money's real nice. It's real nice. Especially if you're lazy like me. I mean, I want to sleep all day. I don't want to make a party when it's dark. What's so funny?
You like Bethany?
Whiskey. I don't like whiskey. I love whiskey.
I have good whiskey. Not bad whiskey.
I think we should try some and find out.
Ish.
Molly is doing a lot in that scene. It's, you know, she's trying to figure this guy out, and in a way she has, but in a way she hasn't, because of course he's plotting to, you know, marry into her family and take her oil money.
Right. And at that point, like, you know, people were starting to pass away. And it was a really difficult transitional time for Osage. And this is also a generation, kind of like the first and second generation that had gone through boarding schools. So Molly and her sisters being boarding school survivors as well. So there's a whole lot of contextualized history behind that. And a lot of that also came from Charles Redcorn's book, A Pipe for February, which talks about this period of time. It's a novel that writes about the Osage Reign of Terror from an Osage perspective. And kind of how, like, the slow rise in, you know, as people are dying, the rise in paranoia was kind of slow. Because there's a lot of things that community would attribute these deaths to that were related to historical trauma. It wasn't immediately obvious that people were being poisoned to death, you know. And, you know, like you see, like, these new folks coming in, that initial wave is like, oh, these guys are new. And it's like, there's a flirtation that happens. There's an exoticism that's happening on both sides. So me and the sisters definitely etched that out in that scene where we're gossiping about the men.
Right, what do you think that she sees in Ernest?
You know, it's a dynamic that I'm very used to seeing, even in my own family. It's kind of a sustaining one, and I think you can find it in a lot of relationships. Just this kind of fun-loving, larger-than-life, you know, inappropriate sometimes, goofy cowboy of a guy with this very self-possessed, like, humble, you know, like, you know, acting on protocol native woman that he just lives to crack her shell and make her laugh, and like how much joy she gets from that too. So just kind of that back and forth, you know. That scene underwent a couple of different changes, and you know, you pointed to it, the trickster element of it. It's not going to be explicitly clear to the audience when Molly calls him Shomikas, he calls him Coyote. She's not just calling him the animal, she's calling him a trickster. Because one of the trickster figures in oral tradition with Osage is Coyote. And there's several of them, but Coyote's like the fop, is the one that's always tripping over his own feet, acting very hedonistically in self-interest, and he never really wins. You know, he'll screw up everything for everybody involved in the story in a very funny way, especially when you're telling it to kids. But in the end, he just never wins. When I was learning these stories, a lot of them reminded me of our trickster stories, Blackfeet stories. Even though the structure's different, the landscape's different, like, kind of the progression of the stories and the humor of them felt very familiar. And it gave Ernest a place to hide.
You know, it's funny. Some of the movies that it called to mind for me are actually these kind of domestic dramas like Gaslight with Ingrid Bergman and, you know, Suspicion with Joan Fontaine and Cary Grant, these stories of women who are married to men who they slowly realize are terrorizing them. And of course, that gets more acute as the film goes on. And, you know, she is starting to realize that he's not only responsible for the deaths of her family members, but is actively poisoning her through her insulin. And for the audience, you reach a point where you kind of want to scream at her to wake up and just run away from the guy. And yet she doesn't do that. And you start to wonder how much is she seeing right through him when he's lying to her face? How much is she deluding herself? I'm curious, was that the question for you as the story goes on?
Well, where I found a place that Molly would have had a huge blind spot in all of that, I mean, one, it's like what you suspect in your subconscious mind we've gotten conditioned to dismissing if, you know, what's right in front of us doesn't check out. You know, he's so good with the kids and he just doesn't seem capable of it. But one of the biggest clues for me, especially during that period of time where Molly's getting the insulin, the family has pretty much surmised she was also getting a combination of arsenic and morphine. So there was the delivery process, having a long time ago played a morphine addict in my first play and doing the research about that, the chemical dependency on that, how the immediate relief of everything, that was a clue to me that, okay, Ernest is the delivery mechanism. Mm. So while her subconscious and conscious mind are dancing with each other so much, while her body is being eroded by arsenic, but also healed by insulin, and she's addicted to the whole process, the only thing that she sees consistently is Ernest that's bringing this to her, that's bringing her this relief. So when she does have a sober mind later, unknowingly, that's how I approach those end scenes as well. It's just people in my life I've been close to who are recovering addicts and who are leaving toxic, abusive, codependent relationships with, you know, be it with people or be it with substance. That was a big clue to me that, you know, gave me some compassion for what Molly wasn't seeing, what she was incapable of seeing. And even if she was seeing and suspecting it, incapable of leaving, literally.
I am a studier of Oscar history, and I know that in the past, it's been a real mixed experience for people who have been the firsts in their category. One story, Sidney Poitier, of course, was the first black man to win Best Actor in 1964. And not after he won for Lilies of the Field, he was being honored at the mayor's office in New York City. And the reporters kept asking him about civil rights. And he finally snapped. He was not a person who generally snapped, and said, "Why is it everything you guys ask refers to the negroness of my life and not my acting?" I'm curious if you have felt that sort of tension of being out here as an actor, but also as, you know, the face of a community. And in addition to that, you're playing an Osage woman, so it's not even quite your community.
One thing that I've really appreciated is I'm friends with Sterling Harjo, the creator of Reservation Dogs. And, you know, we're both in the circuit right now for both of these projects. And so when we were catching up and just visiting about kind of this shared space we're finding ourselves navigating, he put it really well. He said, "We're in a position where we've, like, you know, we're kicking the door in." But kind of the reality of what that is and maybe what it has to be, when you kick the door in, you should just kind of put your foot in the door and stand there. You know, it's like kicking the door in and running through it means it's going to shut behind you. So it's really nice to, you know, remember that while I'm the first specifically Native American indigenous woman, there has been other representation. I stand on the shoulders of a lot of performers, and, like, it's circumstantial. This point in history, the film that I'm in, the performance that I was blessed enough to be able to carry, it's still, it feels like a very shared moment, and it feels like a big responsibility to just be and to, you know, celebrate others and to keep pushing for more representation. So I'm just kind of, if I've kicked the door in, I'm just trying to stand here and leave it open for everybody else to come through.
Well, I will be looking forward to it, and also looking forward to the rest of this crazy award season. Congratulations again, and it's been great talking to you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Michael.
Lily Gladstone won a Golden Globe for her performance in Killers of the Flower Moon, and she's up for an Oscar in March. You can read Michael Shulman at NewYorker.com, and he's the author of Oscar Wars, A History of Hollywood in Gold, Sweat, and Tears.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by Be My Guest with Ina Garten, the podcast. On each episode, Ina welcomes a different friend over to her Hamptons home to share stories about career, love, and life, all while cooking up an amazing meal. Guests include New York Times writer Frank Bruni, Jennifer Garner, restaurateur Danny Meyer, and The New Yorker's David Remick. David talks about his love of music and his obsession with Szechuan cooking videos on YouTube. Listen to Be My Guest with Ina Garten wherever you get your podcasts. WNYC Studios is supported by the Natural Resources Defense Council. Using science, the law, and people power, NRDC is committed to confronting the climate crisis, protecting public health, and safeguarding nature. They address the impact of fossil fuels on communities and our environment. They help protect wildlife, public lands, and irreplaceable ecosystems that all living things depend on. They work to enact policies for clean air, clean water, and access to nature for all. You can help NRDC safeguard the Earth for future generations. Visit nrdc.org/WNYC for more information.